Okay, Erev Tov. Okay, I want to welcome everybody. Of course, as you heard Dr. Mark say, this is the last of our series on Zacharia Frankel. We'll be starting next week, The Rav's Letters. We'll give you the exact title just for a few weeks. There's some interesting letters of Rav Soloveitchik. But I want to thank Avi and Rivi Katz, who are sponsoring this evening's the talk, in memory of Avi's father, in loving memory of his father, Dr. Norman Katz, whose fourth yahrzeit is this evening and tomorrow the ninth Shvat. And Dr. Katz was a family man, loved and beloved by his children and grandchildren. He was an Ish Eshkolot, a Renaissance man, a Talmud Chacham, combining the best of Torah Umada. He was a student of Rav Soloveitchik, and he was a professor of mathematics for over 50 years, close to 50 years, and Washington University in St. Louis. And as a family told me, he would greatly appreciate tonight's class being taught by renowned scholar and Talmud Chacham, Dr. Mark. And it's a pleasure, and I want to thank you for your sponsorship and support. As like I always say, the best way to memorialize someone is through the eternal Torah. Our mortality is, you know, that's being a human, but Torah is eternal. So I want to thank you, and have long life and good memories. Okay, Dr. Mark, Bavakasha.
Yes, and thank you. And I'll just add that Washington University in St. Louis has it's become very hot, especially for the Orthodox students, and is a very, very nice community there. I flew down there a few years ago, and it's really very nice. Today, as Rabbi Kelman said, will be the last class on Rabbi Zacharia Frankel. I want to go right into it and maybe probably take us maybe half hour, and then I want to wrap everything up. But with the comments, I'll get to Eric's question about we did this I think in one of the first couple classes, but we're going to sum it up again. Hopefully you answer it. If not, we will spend some more time on it. And for those of you who sent in comments and questions I didn't get to, I'll try to get to them today. I'll go as long as it takes to get to them. So let me get right into it. Before I do it, just one point I want to make, because I want to give credit, although I didn't get it from him. I should mention it anyway, that there was an article in Hakira in the year 2009, Hakira 8, by Chaim Lander, who I knew. I mean, actually was at his wedding, but if you're listening, Chaim, it's been a long time since we've communicated. He's described as studying in a kollel in Staten Island, New York, a very nice article on Shir, or Shlomi Yehuda Rappaport. It's called Champion of Jewish Unity in the Modern Era, and it deals a lot with Frankel. And on the very first page, he mentions the a sense of the position Frankel held among traditional Jews before the controversy can be seen by the New Orleans, you know, issue about erecting a monument, that one of the rabbis they turned to is Frankel. I made that exact same point, but I have seen this article, but that's not why I made it. I didn't even remember that he made that point. I was reading over the, because of my project on Halacha in America, I was reading over the book. So we came to the same conclusion ourselves, but then he had something else interesting, that Hermann Cohen sent a letter to Hirsch's Yeshurin defending his Rebbe. Hermann Cohen, the great scholar, very influential, Rav Soloveitchik had great interest in Hermann Cohen, and wasn't his dissertation on Hermann Cohen? I forget now the title of the Rav's dissertation. Was it Max Schell or Hermann Cohen?
It wasn't Hermann Cohen.
Exactly. Okay. So Hermann Cohen describes Frankel as an observant Jew who conducted himself in all respects in accord with the strict interpretation of Jewish law, such as, quote, standing in the synagogue with the talus over his head, singing Zemiros on Shabbos, and also sometimes commenting in the Shiurim that the Yerei Shamayim should be Machmir. So people know Hermann Cohen as a great philosopher. They don't know him as someone also who studied under Frankel. Okay, the last class, where we were, was I was reading you Hildesheimer's opinion. And there's one more letter I want to summarize for you, Israel Hildesheimer. If you recall, he was asked by this Musmach of Frankel, like, why Hildesheimer rejects the Musmachim of Frankel, and that his point was that some of us are completely observant and our ideas are correct. In the last letter that Hildesheimer responds to him, he responds to the question, how can the students, the faithful students of Frankl, be joined together with Hildesheimer students? And Hildesheimer says to him, unfortunately, I don't have an answer that'll satisfy you. The only way I could see this is that, first of all, that we have to look at Breslau students. They would have to be Lamdanim, you know, worthy of Lefachot Ra'oi L'Hora'a. That is, they can Paskin Shilas, which is a high level, but that's what they wanted people in Berlin. We don't expect people graduating, let's say, from Yeshiva University, rabbinical school, to be able to Paskin. I don't think we expect that from any of the yeshivas. But in Berlin, one of the requirements was that you had to write three teshuvot that they gave you, and you had to come up with it, because in those days, you were being a rabbi in a small town, you would have to Paskin Shilas. We're not saying maybe the most difficult ones, but you had to have that ability. Two, that the Breslau graduate had to be completely observant in his views and in his actions. And finally, he says that, and after these things are met, then he says, we will examine it. And he says about the point of being a Talmudic scholar. This is what's interesting. Hildesheimer says that even the opponents of Dr. Frankl, Zichrono Livracha, so he gives Frankl the title after his name, or not a title, the term of blessed memory. This is something Hirsch went to. When Frankl was alive, Hildesheimer battled with him. But after his passing, you see that he was willing to give him this kavod. It shows you more moderation in Berlin. He says that everyone acknowledged that Frankl was a Lamdan Muflag, was a great, great Lamdan. And if anyone had the desire to, if you were prepared Talmudically, you can learn a lot from him. And then he says, and what's the situation today, however? Gretz is teaching Talmud there. And he says, can Gretz teach Talmud? He says there's no Yirat Shamayim there. When you have someone like Gretz teaching Talmud, no one's going to come out with proper Yirat Shamayim. And then he says, as long as Gretz is working at the seminary, we cannot give any trust to the students. Why? Because Ein Somchen HaHanes. He says, you can't assume that someone's going to come out being taught by Gretz and become observant. Now, we saw Drachman. Drachman comes out completely observant in every way, but I guess Hildesheim would say that's a miracle. And then his answer is, therefore, that really, he says, it hurts me to say this, but we have to remain with good personal relationships, me and you, but I cannot acknowledge the legitimacy of Musmachim from the Breslau Seminary. And then we have here a letter, a public letter that Hildesheimer issued. He was asked, can a Orthodox Jew accept the fact that a Breslau graduate becomes a rabbi in his community? And he says, since the overwhelming majority, or the Roba Hamachria, of students from this seminary, and maybe all of them, he says, violate certain mitzvot derabanan, like carrying in a carmelite on Shabbat, stam yenam, and milk that's from non-Jews. So today we might say that that's not such a problem, but in Germany, I guess it was an issue that the religious would only drink Chol Yisrael. He says, and now this is a chiddush to me, that he's saying that they basically all carry on Shabbat and they drink stam yenam. That's not the impression you get from Drachman or other sources. And he says that we know that they've taken positions in liberal communities where they've made compromises on other matters of halacha. Therefore, I have to tell you that we cannot have faith in them. By the way, I mentioned last class, Professor Rabbi Gudeman, the Rav of Vienna, in the main show there. I want to show you what he looked like. Hold on a second here. Here is what he looked like. Looks like a Shomer Shabbos, and he was a Shomer Shabbos, but he was definitely a Breslau a graduate, a traditionalist, but not his views were not what we would regard as orthodox, despite the way he looked. Okay, so let's sum up a little bit what we've seen and maybe take it forward for a few minutes before I return to some other things. As we've seen, the followers, and these classes were not about Frankl per se as an individual. They weren't about his biography. He wrote various books we would have dealt with if that was the case. I was really only interested in the positive historical school in that aspect of Frankl, his contributions, much like when we dealt with Reform, and I dealt with Geiger a whole time. I only was interested in Reform Judaism. It's obvious that the followers of positive historical Judaism, Frankl in particular, are very much connected to Judaism, but they also had a critical spirit. Frankl believed in a synthesis of modern scholarship and belief, and this was carried through by his students. As far as he was concerned, this would also enable Jews to best deal with the effects of emancipation, which was leading to widespread rejection of Judaism, that we're not closed off, that we can be part of the great world and modern scholarship. He did stress faith. We saw that there were boundaries, red lines, if you want to call it. But what set him apart from the Orthodox was where he drew the lines. Torah, Misinai, five books of Moses, no critical approaches. But when it came to halacha, development of halacha, even understanding in a non-literal fashion, as we saw, halacha Moshe Misinai, the hermeneutical rules, that he was willing to attribute to the genius of the rabbis and their connection to the Torah. We spoke in great detail, I'm not going to repeat it, about how the ultimate arbiter for Frankl was the folk, the people, that they are the repository of revelation. And therefore, if religious people want to alter certain practices, we're not talking about Torah practices, let's say rabbinic practices and obviously customs, then that is a form of divine revelation. And that could, when you look at the sense of the faithful, then the rabbis can give imprimatur for that. What sets him apart from the Orthodox is where he sets the line when it comes to faith. Other than Torah, everything was open. And if you go to a place like Bar Ilan today, I have to say that much of the scholarship there is very much in line with Zacharia Frankl. Professor Gilat, for instance, Yitzchak Gilat, taught at Bar Ilan. He's a professor of Talmud for many years. And he published a book, and he basically showed to his satisfaction that no Gezeirah Shavah really is goes back to Sinai. He spoke about development of laws. So, for instance, the idea that Bar Mitzvah is age 13, he shows when this idea began, and earlier rabbis didn't know it. And he was attacked in Hamayan, which is the journal I mentioned last class, and that's where the Hildesheimer letters were published, of the German Orthodox. He was attacked for doing scholarship, which basically is a Zacharia Frankl scholarship. And Gilat would respond, you're right, but that's what's correct. And it's not just Zacharia Frankl, it's not just Bar Ilan, Yeshiva University. The fact is that many practicing Orthodox Jews, if you look at their scholarship, those who deal with the Talmudic period, but not just the Talmudic period, it's really Frankelian. Of course, we mentioned positive historical because there's an element of positivity. It's not reform. It's not just what you're going to take away, but faith is what's positive. And what needs to be accepted on faith? The Sinai revelation. Everything else, we're given the authority to examine critically. By the way, here's something I haven't mentioned yet, the stress on historic continuity. Well, we did see the great attachment to the Hebrew language. Frankl went to the rabbinic conference of the Reform rabbis to see what it was about. And when he saw that even Hebrew was not important to them, he walks out. But Frankl also, and he's really the first of his type of rabbis to speak about Jewish connection to the land of Israel and a future of Jewish independence in the land. I want to read you some here from Rivka Horowitz's collection of Frankl's essays, page 111. And that's where you see that he speaks about the idea of Zionism, of at least the return to the land of Israel. He says that this hope for a return to the land of Israel does not mean that we're not loyal to the lands we live in, or that we see ourselves as foreign, but this is our eschatological hope. He says that we are connected to the land of our fathers with our memories, and we believe that once again we will be a free people there, and we'll be able to be honored in the land. And even though we've suffered thousands of years of persecution and troubles, we have not given up hope, and we still hold on to this idea of independence. independence, renewed independence, and we hope to bring it to fruition. So here Frankel is speaking in a way that, look, even Hirsch believed in the future that there would be a messianic era, but Frankel is speaking about it in a much more realistic sort of way. He also acknowledged, as we saw, the need for flexibility in halakha, because flexibility is what would enable Jewish religious life to go on. And as we said, this takes into account the will of the people. That's the great message of Frankel, I think, that the practices of the community are themselves a form of revelation that must be recognized, just like the revelation of God on Sinai. There's two revelations. There's a revelation from the divine revealing the Torah, and then there's the revelation in the will of the people, but the religious people, not the irreligious, not the ones who are, they're the completely observant ones. They show us the direction of how halakha should move. And that's what changes. Changes, that's what's the entire community. So really, it's the community, not God, not the individual. That's the ultimate arbiter determining what we do, what we don't do. And I mentioned how we have this in traditional sources: Kol Hamon Kol Shaddai, Iminam Nevim B'nei Nevim Heim. Because of this, Frankel was more willing than the Orthodox to introduce minor revisions of the prayer book. I mentioned a few of them. Here's another one in V'hurachum of Tachanun. We said it this morning. There's a passage there, quote, "They," that is Israel's enemies, "have detested us like the impurity of a nidah. How long will your strength remain captive and your glory in the hand of the foe? Arouse your might and zeal against your enemies that they may be put to shame." Now, he omitted this. He never published a sitter with this, but he stated his opinion publicly that this sort of expression, we're not dealing with these type of Gentiles today. So he says in mid-19th century Germany, and therefore we shouldn't use terms like this. It's no different than Shem Yishtach HaVarik, Mizpah HaMelel Yeshia, which was removed, although now people are putting it back, but it was taken out. There is one reform he did. I have to acknowledge that I don't know what gave him the justification for it. Even if the people were, I mean, it's not like the people were, maybe his congregation was interested in this, but it's not the people as a whole. And that Meyer discusses on page 106 that on the Tisha B'Av in Dresden, when he was serving as an Orthodox rabbi, people did not, he's very moving. He describes it here that there was only a pale shimmer of light. It was a very moving service. However, the people did not sit on the floor. And I would say, well, fine, people don't always sit on the floor. But he says, at least the memoir writer says, that they had to, people remove their shoes, but no one was permitted to bring low benches or sit on the floor. So at least the way it's described, they did not allow people to sit on the floor. I'm not sure. I mean, it's explicit in the Shulchan Aruch that you have to sit on the floor. So I don't know what that is about. And maybe it's a misunderstanding. Maybe this bear who was observing it just saw the people come in and sit on the benches, and he just assumed that they weren't allowed. Frankel never wrote about it, and we don't know the details why that happened. So I'm not sure how that would be justified. So this notion that we've seen then develops. Solomon Schechter takes it, he develops it into a concept, that is the idea that the actions of the people are a revelation, and that really determines the direction of Judaism. Solomon Schechter takes this, he develops it into a concept with the worst, one of the worst names ever given to a Jewish concept, Catholic Israel. Think of Catholic with a small c, meaning totality of Israel. But he could have come up with a better title, University of Israel. Why he picked such a crazy title, I don't know. But in 1915, writing about Catholic Israel, he stated as follows, quote, "Another consequence of this conception of tradition is that neither scripture nor primitive Judaism, but general custom, forms the real rule of practice." That is what the people do. That's at the end of the day. It's what Klal Yisrael decides to do, that's going to determine the direction of the religion. And that's in Masechta Sofrim. It says, "Ein halacha nikbas ad sheyehei minhag," that we can't really establish what the halacha is until the practice is. Look at what the people do. And really, the strength of Frankl's position is that it dafka appeals to the middle, that it's a moderate position. The ironic thing, I would add, is that if we follow Frankl and Schechter and include in Catholic Israel only those who are observant of Jewish law, then it seems that today, almost none of those who identify with conservative Judaism would be included in the category of Catholic Israel. So they were very clear that it has to be the observant Jewish community, and much of halacha in the Orthodox world is also developed by using this notion of Catholic Israel. I already mentioned many examples where the poskim, after the fact, say, well, this is already Minhag Yisrael, so therefore we have to be Melamed Tzfus. But this is the great irony that the descendants of Frankl, at least the intellectual descendants, are not really the arbiters of what Catholic Israel would be. It would only be in later years, after Solomon Schechter, that the conservative movement would move even further away from Frankl's position on faith and Schechter's position. Remember, what did Schechter call biblical criticism? He called higher biblical criticism. You have lower criticism, which is textual, and higher, that's source criticism. He called it the higher anti-Semitism, which is a nice turn of a phrase. By the way, just like Catholic Israel is a terrible expression, biblical criticism is a terrible expression. Like when you're in high school and you hear it, you think it's about criticizing the Bible. When it's amazing how often you run into people like in the Haredi world, they think biblical criticism is about these academics, you know, criticizing the Bible and things like that. When, of course, it has nothing to do with that. It has to do with criticism in the sense of a critical attitude towards a text, analysis. But that was Schechter's position, obviously Frankl's position as well. But by the time you get to Louis Ginzburg, you have a whole, obviously the seminary would accept higher criticism later, but Louis Ginzburg, Gaon Shebegaonim in terms of learning. It's possible that in the 1930s, he's the greatest Talmud scholar in America. 1940s as well. I mean, unbelievable Lamdin. And yet you can see his article on the Torah in the Jewish Encyclopedia, the early part of the 20th century. Because of that, he did not get a job at Hebrew Union College, because Isaac Meir Wise, even though he's a reformer, he's a believer in Torah Misinai. He was a Ginzburg did accept the higher criticism, and he writes as follows. In his biography of Frankl, in his book Students, Scholars, and Saints, and speaking of the apparent contradiction between the openness to modern scholarship of the historical school and following the mitzvot, that is, you might find it strange, because on the one hand, you have the reformers who accept all the higher criticism, and they don't follow the mitzvot, because in their mind, they don't have any meaning to us today. And we know the origin, that all these books are simply ancient texts influenced by Babylonians, that the Jews wrote it, or Assyrians, whatever the era of the text. And we understand the Orthodox who believe it's divine will. But what about if you believe in higher criticism? Should you observe mitzvot? And friend Ginzburg says, absolutely, you should. And he says as follows, although this is more radical than what Frankl or Schechter ever said, this is what he says, quote, and he's describing himself. One may, for instance, conceive of the origin and idea of Sabbath rest as the professor of Protestant theology at a German university would conceive it, namely as something invented by people years ago. And yet minutely observe the smallest detail of the Sabbath observances known to strict orthodoxy. For an adherent of this school, the sanctity of the Sabbath reposes not upon the fact that it was proclaimed on Sinai, but on the fact that the Sabbath idea found for thousands of years its expression in Jewish souls. It is the task of the historian to examine into the beginnings and developments of the numerous customs and observances of the Jews. Practical Judaism, on the other hand, is not concerned with origins, but regards the institutions as they have come to be. From this point of view, the evaluation of a law is independent of its origin, and thus the line of demarcation between biblical and rabbinical law almost disappears. What Ginzburg is saying is basically what became the conservative approach. That is, when it comes to scholarship, we have complete absolute freedom to examine it. And if your conclusion is that the laws of the Sabbath were simply influenced by ancient you know, texts from, let's say, the Assyrian world, and you deny Exodus and Sinai and all this thing, it doesn't matter. Because what matters is that the laws that have come down to us for thousands of years, that is how we express our spirituality. That is how we connect to God. That is what gives them legitimacy. And that is seen as an outgrowth of the Frankel and Schechter idea, even though Frankel and Schechter never had this notion about Torah, but the very idea that at the end of the day, the true revelation is in the people. And this is how Jews express spirituality. The Torah to us is the fact that this is how we, so even if humans wrote it, it doesn't matter, because it's how humans express their connection to God. And this is what God wants. So it's a belief in God, downplaying the role of Torah, but upgrading the role of the people. The people created the Torah, because the Torah is what enables us to connect to God and express our spirituality, and that is God's will. And that's what Ginsberg means when he says there's really no difference between rabbinic law and Torah law, because at the end of the day, everything comes from the people. And this is, I guess, Catholic Israel updated. Nothing that Frankel or Schechter ever imagined, but this then becomes the conservative ideology. And I have to say that it has a coherence, and maybe we'll do classes on Mordechai Kaplan. I mean, Mordechai Kaplan also speaks of the idea of folkways and the same sort of idea that this is how Jews connect through. There's something called the genetic fallacy. Don't assume that something's value is dependent on its origins. And that's exactly what Ginsberg is saying. The value of the Shabbos has nothing to do with the origins, where you think it comes from, or any of these laws. It has to do with what they mean to us today. And that God created us as a people with the ability to have this great sense of spirituality. We're the people of God, and we have, however it came about, it doesn't matter, because this is what the Torah means to us. It's how we connect to God, and that gives it its own legitimacy, and its origin is irrelevant. But that would take us into 20th century understandings of conservative theology, and I think maybe some of you have asked for classes on Mordechai Kaplan, so Mordechai Kaplan, although comes out of that school, but then moves off in a different direction as well. But what I just elaborated is really conservative legal thinking and theology, conservative with a small C, with a large C. So that's something that we can take up another time, but it's an outgrowth, but it's not something Frankel ever would have countenanced in his time, because he said absolutely, this is completely against basics of principles of faith. So, of course, the conservative answer would be that it's not so important what Frankel or Schechter said in their time. It's what they would have said if they were alive today. In their day, biblical criticism was identified with an attempt to, caricature Judaism as a legalistic religion, push it off, place it against the Christianity, which is the supersessionism, which is the culmination of what Judaism should have been, but never was able to, see the message of the prophets and emancipate itself from all these laws. So it's understandable, they'll say, that Schechter and Frankel reacted this way. But now that we see things in a different, more objective way from an academic standpoint, we can look at it differently. And this is the theology and the conservative if you look in the Chumash they published. And each volume is – well, no, I forgot what it's called, the red volume, the conservative Chumash. That's the approach, and that's the approach that's taught at the seminary, and maybe we'll return to it later. What I want to do is say a couple more things about Frankel and then wrap up with some interesting comments. If I had more time, I would have gone into some of Frankel's writings. One of his writings – yes, thank you, Eric. It's fine. One of Frankel's works is a small booklet dealing with the status of rabbinic law when it comes to marriage. And I found that Frankel makes an interesting point. He speaks about polygamy. And he makes the point that in the Talmudic period, which a number of people have made, the rabbis were not polygamists. If I'm not mistaken, the entire Talmud, there's not one reference to a rabbi with more than one wife. If I'm wrong, then it's only one or two. But you think of all the stories of the rabbis. And Frankl offers an amazing proof for this, not just from the fact that you don't see it, but I'm going to show you something which, at least I thought it was quite fascinating. And it's in Yevamos that it talks about in the Mishnah that if you bring a get, and it says an agent who brought a bill of divorce from a country overseas and says it was written in my presence and was signed in my presence may not marry this woman. That he's testifying about the get, because we're assuming that maybe he wants to marry her. So that's why he's saying that, that this is a valid get. We can understand that. But then Frankl points out something really interesting that he says that. Where is it? Then we have examples of where this doesn't apply, that, when people, it's okay, their testimony, etc. We don't need to go into that. But look what it says in the Mishnah. And for all of these who were involved in permitting the wife to remarry, namely a judge, an agent who brought the bill of divorce, and one who testified for a woman, her husband died, if they had wives at the time of the ruling or the testimony, and their wives died thereafter, then these women they had set free are permitted to be married to them. In other words, the Mishnah tells us that if, let's say, I'm involved in this case and I'm married, then we believe me. We don't assume I'm saying these things to marry the woman. Well, why don't we assume that? I can have more than one wife. Frankl shows, this shows that even in the days of Chazal, they weren't concerned with this. It was understood that a man only took one wife, so much so that we're not hoshesh, we're not worried that someone involved in the divorce is going to say, well, he's going to do something false, so then he can marry this woman. Because no, he only marries one woman. I think that's an amazing thing he pointed out. I also want to show you another point. This is mentioned about by Shimon Steinmetz, his blog on the main line a number of years ago. I did not know about it, so I give him credit. Another Sefer published in 1863, which is only a couple of years after the controversy. The controversy of Darchei Mishnah is 1859, so I guess it took a few years for this to sink in. But there was a Rav in Slonim named Rav Yehuda Edel. He wrote the Sefer called Afike Yehuda, a couple of volumes, Drushos, has been printed a number of times. Well, look at the Haskamot from all the big Rabbanim, including here you have Shir of Prague, you have Yaakov Ettlinger. And here you have Rav of Dresden, none other than Zachariah Frankl. If they reprint this, they're going to remove the Haskama. Yeah, the Haskama of the rabbis of Berlin, in Frankfurt, in Lisa, in all these other cities, in Breslau, Altona. Altona, of course, is Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, Aaron Fuld, and Wurzburger Rav, and Frankl's listed there among the Rabboni. So you have to give credit or blame, however you want to put it. It was really Hirsch that removed him off his perch. And so to this day, when you think about Rabboni, whenever you see people who mention Zachariah Frankl with all the highfalutin titles, they don't know the history. Often Sephardic rabbis might, quote him, Gaon Rav Zachariah Frankl. We have a few Ashkenazim, but for the most part, it's ones who don't know the history. Okay, Ad Kan, Rav Zachariah Frankl, 10 classes. But before we end, I'm going to get to the final comments and questions of all of you. A few things, interesting things, in no particular order. Just things that have been building up on my shelf back there, and not all of them, but just enough to keep us, I guess, from the 25 minutes. We spoke a lot about, in this series and previous series, about the whole idea of interpreting the Talmud at odds with the way the, interpreting the Mishnah at odds with the Talmud in accordance with Pshat. I've cited sources, by the way, the Marshal does this. There's lots of sources I can bring. I want to show you something else. I just happened to see, we're going to Tunisia this summer, God willing. And one of the places we go is Karawan. That's a holy city of Islam. Jews were not allowed to live there from like the 12th century until the French came, and Jews weren't allowed to live there. But it's an important city. We have great figures there. One of them is Rav Chananel. So I'm collecting good stuff about Rav Chananel. If you've been on my trips, you know that I got to speak. So about on the bus about all these places. So I speak a lot about Rabbeinu Chananel. And look what I show you about Rabbeinu Chananel. This is fascinating. What I'm going to show you now. You know, in Erevin, it says as follows. So I pulled up the Erevin here. There's a whole dispute in Erevin about Tisha B'Av falls out Erev Shabbos. Do you fast the whole day Erev Shabbos, or do you stop eating right before Shabbos? Now, that doesn't happen to us because we have a set calendar, and if Tisha B'Av, I believe if Tisha B'Av falls out on Friday, then Rosh Hashanah falls out on Sunday. And we have a principle that it can't. But when they were Mekadesh the Chodesh, then it could. Then there's a dispute. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, the final ruling is that, I have to check. I think that you would fast the whole day. But I don't remember exactly. But this is what, it quoted Brisa. It was taught in the Brisa. Yehuda said, we were once sitting before Rabbi Akiva, and it was the ninth of Av that occurs on Shabbos Eve, and they brought him to Yoshev Erev Tisha B'Av Shachal Yap Erev Shabbos, and they brought him a slightly cooked egg, and he swallowed it without salt. It was not that he desired it so much that he ate it; rather, he did it to show the students that the halacha is that one need not complete the fast when the ninth of Av occurs on Shabbos Eve, so as not enter Shabbos in a state of affliction. By the way, I think this is a mistake, the way the translation here. This is the Koran edition. It's not that one need not complete the fast when the ninth of Av occurs on Erev Shabbos. I think the position is that you're not allowed to complete the fast because you can't go into Shabbos this way. Okay, so we see Rabbi Akiva. They brought him an egg, and he ate it. Not that he was hungry. But he ate it because he wanted to show the halacha that Tisha B'Av Erev Shabbos, you don't complete the fast. Okay, so look at what, on the spot, Rabbeinu Chananel says as follows. V'hadetanya tes ba'av shachal yos b'Erev Shabbos. That which the Brisa says that Tisha B'Av is Erev Shabbos. Ve'ofiu ifnei Rabbi Akiva beitza b'gogelet b'lo melech v'gama. And it says they brought him the egg and he ate it. This is what Rabbi Chananel says. Kabbalah biyadenu. We have a tradition. Ki Rabbi Akiva ba'osa shah masukan hayah. The Rabbi Akiva was ill in a dangerous situation. Ve'uviu ifnei Rabbi Akiva harofim lignoa beitza mugelos. And the doctors brought in this, and they told him, you need to eat it because of health reasons. Bo melech v'akri sayom. Rabbi Yehuda lo dikte kafis remember, he's saying Rabbi Yehuda, who repeats this story, he didn't know the facts. He didn't know that Rabbi Akiva really was ill. And that's why he was eating it. Not because Rabbi Akiva was trying to tell us the halacha that you have to eat, but no, he wouldn't have eaten it otherwise. This implies that Rabbi Chananel's position is that you can't eat on Erev Tisha B'Av. Now, I don't know what this means. They have a Kabbalah. It seems, as if I could be a little Frankelian, it seems that this is sort of like ex post facto. When they don't want people to be led to eat on Erev Tisha B'Av, they come up with this tradition that really Rabbi Akiva didn't do this. And it's against the Gemara. The Gemara doesn't say that. The Gemara is clear. It says explicitly, Rabbi Yehuda says it. But they're saying that Rabbi Yehuda is wrong. So here you have post-Talmudic authorities saying that Rabbi Yehuda has the facts wrong. He saw Rabbi Akiva eating it, and he just assumed that Rabbi Akiva didn't really desire it. He just wanted to show the halacha. But if it's really the case that he was ill, then of course he needed to eat it. But that's not what Rabbi Yehuda says. So this is sort of like a bit of Talmudic criticism here. You have a post-Talmudic authority saying that the Amora doesn't know what he's talking. Well, not Amora. This is Amora. Rabbi Yehuda, Tana, doesn't know what he's talking about. That strikes me as somewhat radical, to put it mildly. But he says it's a Kabbalah. So Rabbi Hanan didn't make it up, but how does Kabbalah, how did it come about? It's critical in a sense like Talmudic criticism. Okay, that's the first thing I want to tell you. Next thing I want to tell you is about Mordechai Kaplan. I said last class, I mentioned that he was in the Teachers Institute. He was in the Teachers Institute, and I wasn't sure whether his classes were in the seminary or in the Teachers Institute. I knew that everyone took the classes, but I looked it up, and he had a joint appointment. I should have known this, that he was not just head of the Teachers Institute. He also was faculty member of the seminary, officially faculty member of the seminary, not just that they took his classes. And he taught also, I asked my son-in-law's grandfather, Rabbi Sylvan Kamens. He taught in 100% taught in the rabbinical school. I looked this up and I saw this as well. He taught for 40 years, homiletics, Jewish philosophy, all those sorts of things. And Rabbi Kamens had him for those. And then I asked him also about Bob Dylan. I wanted to be sure. And I guess he says that he officiated at Bob Dylan's father's funeral in Hibbing. His mother remarried a St. Paul man and became my member at the Temple of Aaron when I was the associate there. So, there it is. Now, as for Kaplan, this came out a couple days ago. Jewish Review of Books. The latest Jewish Review of Books. And there's an article here on page 33 by Jenna Weissman Joselit, a scholar of American Jewish history. To whom it may concern, Mordechai Kaplan, the diarist. There are three volumes of Mordechai Kaplan's diaries that were published, and the fourth volume's coming out. And they didn't publish everything. They picked the good stuff. But he wrote this diary from 1913 until his death, 70 years almost later. And you could fill 10 volumes with notes. Mel sculpted it. He's the expert on Mordechai Kaplan. And I've read the diaries, all three volumes. So I start reading this article, and lo and behold, I read something that I didn't remember this story. And then I go to the journal, which should have it in it. 1942, we're talking about the story, and it's not there either. Sorry, I went to 1932. Sorry, this is the 42, the wrong issue. I went to the 1932 one. I have all the volumes here. But let me read it to you. Well, there's her summary of it. That one Friday evening in 1932, so I went through all the 1932 entries, and I didn't see it, and I'm wondering, where does this come from? But then I, you know, in the middle of the article, I got up, I go downstairs, I start looking for it, and I say, well, I have to then, this is on Shabbos, I have to email her, Joselit, tonight, and I'll ask her, well, where she got this story? It's on the diary. But then I made it to the end. The end of the article, it says, the Jewish Review of Books gratefully acknowledges permission to quote unpublished material from the Mordechai M. Kaplan collections in the archives of the Library of the Jewish Theological Seminary. All this shows me is that there's all sorts of good stuff which they didn't publish. Now, I looked at the Kaplan diaries, and the handwriting is not so easy, so I'm not going to be publishing it. But here's the story. One Friday evening in 32, Mordechai Kaplan decided to pay a Shabbos afternoon social call on his young JTS colleague, Louis Finkelstein, whose wife, Carmel, had recently given birth. Later in the diaries, you see that Kaplan, there's no love lost between Kaplan and Finkelstein. Nah, let's put it this way. But hewing to the protocols of middle-class urban life, this is Joselit's summary, popping over unannounced to a colleague's house was just not done, Kaplan asked his wife, Lena, to first telephone the Finkelsteins to make sure they'd be welcome. Now, this is Friday night. Now, granted that Kaplan was basically a Shomer Shabbos, but on the big things. Famous story is, I don't know if it's true, but it's a good story that he was seen walking on the Upper West Side on Shabbos carrying an umbrella. That's, I guess maybe you could say he held from Manhattan Eruv. But he was asked, Professor Kaplan, why are you carrying? I thought you're Shomer Shabbos. And he said that... I don't have to get wet for a civilization. You know, Judaism is a civilization, but it doesn't mean you get wet. Okay, so they had to call. So the maid answered the phone at the Finkelstein's house and said that Dr. Finkelstein, Mrs. Finkelstein, can't speak on the phone at Shabbos. But if you have a message, tell me. So Kaplan's wife said that, the Kaplans are coming by tomorrow. When they come by the next afternoon, they found the apartment door open. So they didn't have to ring the doorbell. Finkelstein left the door open knowing that Kaplan is going to ring the doorbell. Again, Kaplan, it's hard to know because he speaks about the importance of the Sabbath, but it's sort of like in the big things, not the small things. And Finkelstein greeted him wearing a yarmulke. Of course, it's Shabbos. Finkelstein didn't always wear a yarmulke. In his later years, he always did. But in his early years, we have a picture of Finkelstein together with Mordechai Kaplan. It's not here. It's in one of the volumes. And Finkelstein's not wearing a yarmulke. Later that evening, at his own table, Kaplan told his teenage daughters about the visit, but said nothing about the conversation or even the new baby. Instead, he went on and on about Finkelstein's, quote, assumed airs of orthodoxy, from his refusal to answer the phone to his leaving the door ajar to wearing a cap all the time. His daughters were puzzled and pushed him to clarify his position. If he refused to travel on the Sabbath, why did it bother him that Finkelstein refused to answer the phone on Shabbos? Kaplan said, I must admit that I was nonplussed, Kaplan recalled. What could I say? It's a good question. Kaplan's so annoyed that Finkelstein actually called him, that he on his so-called orthodoxy, and yet Kaplan himself is saying that people shouldn't drive. Kaplan never would have driven over Finkelstein's house, so why is it bothering that Finkelstein is actually observing Shabbos the way it should be observed? So, interesting. Okay, now I want to show you something else. Maosur. Here's Maosur. So we have lots of people who contacted me, and I thank Daniel very much, because he reminding everyone, Maosur Yeshuti, Lachan El Shabech, Tikon Beit Tefilati, Nisham Todan Zabech. Why is it Tikon Beit Tefilati? We know that Bayit is masculine, even though it has a tough ending, and even though people make mistakes sometimes, as we saw. People make a sense with the hey. I can't tell you how many Hasidic works have in them. Ma'aseh, Ma'aseh, Nora'ah. Just look at those. Ma'aseh, Nora'ah. All this discussion of these great stories, the great Ma'aseos of the Rabbani. Ma'aseh, the word Ma'aseh is a masculine word. It's not a feminine word. But for the Hasidim, it's become a feminine word. But so my question was, why Tikkun? And what does Tikkun mean there? I'm assuming, as I said, it's Nifal. A third person feminine. And okay, so one answer was that this is working off Tehillim. If you look in Tehillim 141:2, what does it say? We all know this. Tikon tefilati ketor tefanecha. Let my prayer be set forth and incense before you. So we see tikon together with tefilati. So look back at Maosur. Tikon beit tefilati. So the two are connected. So they kept with the language that everyone knows. And I suggested last time, it's not my own suggestion. It actually comes from Rav David Chai Cohen. David Chai Cohen is a son-in-law, as I believe, of Rabbi Herbert. Is Rabbi Herbert Goldstein or Aaron Reichel? One of these. I forget who. No. It's Herbert Goldstein's son-in-law is Shari Yashov Cohen, right? David Chai Cohen. No. David Chai Cohen's son-in-law of Rabbi Silver. Eliezer Silver's son, David Silver of Harrisburg. His son-in-law is Rav David Chai Cohen. He's a big person in Merkaz Harav. There's many yeshivas under his sway. But he's the one who pointed out that the reason it's passive, Tikkun Beit Tefilati, is not to take sides in this machokas or the Rambam and Rashi. Is the Beis Hamikdash going to be built by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, or are we going to build it? I also said that some people see it as second person, passive, whatever that would mean. Nifal. Well, Daniel contacted, and I thank you, Daniel, for this. He wrote to Shulamit Elitzur. Shulamit Elitzur is, I think it's probably fair to say, the leading expert on piyut in the world at the moment. So, what does she have to say about this? That's, so I thank you, Daniel. And she's also not sure about it, but she says that she always assumed, she says, that Tikkun here is actually second person. That is, it's a request from God to build the Beis HaMikdash. The problem is, she says, is that it's in Nifal. Why, if it's in, it shouldn't be in Nifal then. But she says that there are times in Tanakh where you see similarities where things don't make sense, but it works. And she gave, this is the example she gives, and you all know this example. Chapter 20 in Mishlei at Well, you know this. I think you know. Well, not this verse. Actually, you know the next verse I'm going to show you. If you look in chapter, this is what she calls 2018. It says, "Machshavot be'etza tikkon, u'metachabulot asay milchamot." Machshavot, thoughts or purpose, be'etza tikkon. Now the translation we have here, JPS, every purpose is established by counsel. But what do you mean it's established by counsel? It's machshavot, so it should be plural. Not tikkon, but plural feminine, not singular. So she says that here too, tikkon is to be understood as you. Even though it's like a shortened of like tachonein or whatever it would be, that it's a shortened, it's not really a PL. She says the parallel is uvtach buot asay. So we're saying the second part of it, the first part is parallel, the second part is it's a command. So the first part is also, it's the same thing. And it's possible. I looked in the commentaries, a number of commentaries do interpret tikkun the way she does. Others, however, interpret it differently, and they interpret it as passive. So why isn't it plural? They interpret tikkun every machshava. Machshavot be'etzat tikkun, every single machshava. Neiri interprets it that way. Then I looked in the Dat Mikra. And Dat Mikra, they say that it's tikkun, b'lashon yachid, even though it should be rabim. They don't really, but they do call attention to a similar case. In this one we all know, in Mishlei, chapter 3, verse 18, what does it say? She's a tree of life to those that lay hold on her. Tomcha, what's tomcha mean? Tomcha is plural. So why is it milshar, not milsharim? And that's, if you look at Dat Mikra, it's all they can say is that we have examples. I mean, if you look in the commentaries try to say, well, it means like yes, it's plural, but Meushara means every individual of the plural. But take a look at, they give other examples of this where psukim that look plural, we have to read them as singular. Two of the examples they give, incidentally, from later in, Das Nikra, two of the examples they give from later in this very chapter, look down, below. Altomar, Lereyecha. It was said originally in plural, it seems, but they changed it to Lereyecha. Or the previous verse. Altino Tova Balav, Biot El. It looks like the Ktiv is Yadecha. And they change it to Yadecha. So, because it's supposed to be singular. So then why is it written with plural? Well, either you could write it with plural and still mean singular. Or they thought there was a mistake in it. I'm not sure. But take a look at the Dat Mikra.
Rabbi Mark.
Yeah, hold on. I'm almost done. And then we'll have two more points. And then I'll take the questions and comments.
Okay.
Because we deal with Hirsch. I think you'll find this. Our Hirschians here. This just came on auction just a couple days ago. It's a letter from the Hirsch's wife, Johanna, to Shamshon Raphael Hirsch. So why am I telling you this? Because this is the sort of thing that the Art Scroll biography won't include, but it's very nice to see. For those who are not with us, I'm just going to read it. She writes about her, it's an intimate letter. Where do I want to tell you? Johanna often waxes poetic as she discusses here topics ranging from serious, such as her faith in God, to trivial, asking the name of a young lady that the rabbi, that is Hirsch, had earlier quoted. She closes the letter, quote, "Believe me, no one on earth is more devoted to you than your Johanna, who loves you above all expression." So I had a post on the sermon blog, you could see it, about love before marriage. Because in the Haredi world, they're constantly taught that love only comes after marriage, that you can't have love before marriage. And that's the pasuk where it says that, who is it? Yitzhak, right? Says he loves her after he got married. Is it Yitzhak or Yaakov? It's Yitzhak, I think.
Vatahilo li shava yehoveha vayinachem Yitzhak achreimo.
Thank you very much, Nissa. But I brought examples where we see, this is mentioned because of the case of the Nassim Hamanetsky's book, Making of a Gadol, where presumably the reason that Rivka Zalman was upset with the letters of Aaron sent is because they were love letters. But I gave examples. I quoted how the Rav Yaakov Weinberg, who was in Berlin at the time, says that the Rav was supposed to marry Rav Chaim Heller's daughter. And he says, and this is Adrian Amana from Rav Yaakov Weinberg, but while he was in Berlin, he fell in love with Tanya, who'd be the Rebbetzin. Now, I showed this to Professor Tursky, and he says he doesn't think it's true. But Tursky was not there, and Sridi Yesh was there. And then Tursky told me that Atara, his wife, was actually, that when she was born, Rabbi Weinberg was the first one at the hospital. That shows how close they were. But the Sridi Yesh writes that that was supposed to be the Shidduch, but Rabbi Soloveitchik met Tanya and fell in love. He died. That's, I think, the word he uses. And we have other examples of it as well. I cite a number of examples of this. And finally, the last thing I want to do, and this gets back to the issue that we discussed, kashrus, restaurants in the olden days, and places that didn't have hashkacha. And in fact, Rabbi Yellen pointed out to me, and I got my copy in the latest issue of the Journal of Halachic Contemporary Society, Rabbi Yonah Reese has a whole article on this, because they made a takana in Houston, and I guess in Chicago, communities are making takanot that you can't buy food from a place, no matter how pious the proprietor is, if it's not under hashkacha. And that's the new norm. And I actually think it makes sense, because otherwise we have a problem. It's not easy. What the rabbi is going to say, that this person can sell food and this person can decree. It's like the reason why rabbis often don't eat at people's houses. Because what are you going to do? You can't tell one person that it's okay and then you'll insult someone else. So I fully support the takana. It makes sense. And the takana actually goes back, as you see, in the 19th century. Rabbanim had already made such a takana. But I also have to tell you that I violate this takana all the time. I'm living in Scranton. And every time I have an event, the local Chabad Rebbetzin makes the food for me and my people. And I pay her. And it's a little business. So what am I supposed to do? That's how it's always been. If I go, would go have to work for Microsoft, and they sent me to, I don't know, St. Cloud, Minnesota, my birthplace. If there still is an Orthodox community there, the Jewish tradition is you ask the local rabbi, who's reliable? You find one of the women in the community, she'll agree to cook food for you, and you pay her for it. Wait, you're supposed to eat the food for free? Yeah, she's making it for you. That's always how Jews live. So I get it in a place like Teaneck or other places, but you can't have... You should have it under shlacha, but at the end of the day, this is how Jews always live, that if you're in a place where there isn't food, someone makes it for you, and of course you pay them for the food. So I don't know what this takana, you know, I don't know how, you know, how to enforce it, and if it's really applicable everywhere. But we know this wasn't how it always is. So now I'm going to tell you a few things. I thank Leon for sending me some of this. The old timers might remember this. There was a country club called the Pioneer Country Club. Pioneer Country Club, and I just got details on this from my friend, who's the grandson of Leo Gartenberg. Remember Leo Gartenberg? He wrote a book on Avos. He had a column in Jewish Press. He owned it, him and the Schachter family. Then he bought it. This never had hashkacha, ever. And look what you have here. You have the Agudas Yisrael Convention there. You have here's an ad for it. It's very clear. It's kosher. They say it's kosher. But also the Lake House Hotel never had hashkacha. Kashruth and Sabbath observed. Other hotels did have hashkachas. And they mention it. For example, the Breakers under Moshe Shapiro. What else did I see here?
Sterling.
I don't know. One of them is under the O. Under the OU I saw... But most of them say dietary laws observed. I don't know how strict some of them were today, but one of them is under the OU. I don't know if I could find it here. But the point is they didn't have. And so the Pioneer. So let me show you something about the Pioneer. I have it here. I think you know what happened in the Pioneer Hotel? none other than the wedding of Rav Tendler's daughter. This is the picture that I published, that in Century Village I sold on a guy's mantelpiece when I was there for Scholar in Residence. I asked him to take a picture. He took the picture of it, Jack Prince, if any of you know him. And here you have, and this picture now has been reprinted again and again without anyone knowing that it comes from Mark Shapiro, from Jack Prince, but that's okay. Once you put it on the internet, it's gone. But this is the wedding of Rav Tendler's daughter to Rav Shabtai Rappaport. Now, I was wondering, because if you look at all the ads, and thank you, Leon, for sending me all the ads, they never mention Hashkacha, but I started thinking, and he was wondering too, well, maybe later they did get Hashkacha. You know, maybe by the 70s they did. This took place in 71. So I asked his grandson, Leo Gartner's grandson, and he says as follows. First of all, the hotel, I asked him when it closed. It closed in 74. The hotel never had any hashkacha. Rav HaMashkir and Mashkiach. My grandfather was in effect the Rav HaMashkir and my grandmother in effect the Mashkiach, and she ruled with an iron fist. I vividly remember my grandfather walking in the dining room before every meal, checking the silverware, and he goes on and on and on. And then he tells me that he remembers Rav Tendler's daughter's wedding, and he says that Rav Moshe would come with his entire family and spend Sukkos with us. I knew Reuven, and we would say Rav Reuven, and played with David all the time as a child. So not only could you count on the food, you knew the Sukkah was al pi halacha. So here we see that, and I told you about Simcha Bar Si, where Noah Shkach and Reuven Feinstein's daughter, Shevrachos, was there. So we see that the Pioneer Country Club, as far as I know, everyone ate there, except for someone who was on my trip to Morocco. He told me, I don't know why we got to talking about it, that his father, who knew Leo Gartenberg, once said to him, I can't eat at your hotel, because what's going to happen Erev Shabbos if something comes up? You don't have Mashkiach, and it's going to make a Yetzer Hara for you. And Leo Gartenberg was very offended. But we see Rav Moshe ate there, and others ate there. And that's just part of the tradition. Now, one more thing, which Leon called my attention to, and this is not from the 60s. Like, yeah, this is from 1980. Let's see. I'll tell you what year this is. This is from the Lincoln Square Synagogue little newsletter from 1984. Here you see, this is what I found fascinating. Simchas at Lincoln Square Synagogue, cake caterers, under whose hashgacha? Jonah Kopetsky. But he tells me that Jonah Kopetsky was the owner. And if you didn't want to trust him, then you could get Breuers to give the hashgacha. But otherwise, it's the owner. Now, you might say that that's crazy. How can the owner be the mashgiach? Although Bartons, the mashgiach of Bartons, was always the brother-in-law of the owner, Klein. So that's also a conflict. But this is not so crazy. Because at the end of the day, my shul also has simchas. There's no mashgiach. It's in the shul. So here, it's in the shul. We assume the fact that it's in the shul, the rabbi's in and out. You don't need a mashgiach. When your local shul puts on kiddush Shabbos morning, you don't need a mashgiach. The shul's the mashgiach. So when it says it's under Jonah Kopetsky's supervision, if he was actually doing a simcha at a hotel under his supervision, that would be a chiddush. That would be something. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking at the synagogue itself. I thank you all very much. I'll get to the questions now, comments for another series, which I hope was an interesting series covered, although ostensibly it's about Frankel and the Positive Historical School. We know that we cover all sorts of things. So before I get to the comments, I see a hand being raised, so please speak.
Yeah, Mrs. Kupiecki actually.
It's Kupiecki, not Kupiecki. Okay, yeah.
It's Kupiecki made the first bar mitzvah, which was of my brother in a outside of in a hotel kind of thing. It was the first catered bat mitzvah ever.
Is that the same thing? Because I'm looking at it now. It says Kupiecki. Is that a mistake? It spells it K-U-P-L. Are we talking about the same people?
It's a mistake. Yeah. Jonah Kupiecki.
It's Jonah Kupiecki. I knew him well.
Kupiecki, okay. So I wrote Kupiecki. Okay. I didn't know them. And in the email from the person who sent it, yes, he writes Kupiecki. And this person, by the way, who emailed me is involved in the Midtown Kashrus Avad. He knows all this. Okay, that's interesting. Thank you for
that
story.
Also, Stern family and our family used to go for Pesach to the Ostend Hotel which was a small Kochaline place in Atlantic City. And Kashrus was Mamala, and Tatala ran the place. And Mamala was came running after a waiter who came out to our place with a butcher knife. And my father turned to me and said, "Now that's Kashrus." It was a cleaver, yes. A cleaving knife. That's how they did it. You know, that
yes, that's the old way. And people don't believe this anymore, but that's how it used to be. Not everywhere. Look, if you're at Grossinger's, the people who ran Grossinger's were not personally observant. So you needed a mashgiach. You needed hashgacha at the Concord and all these places which were semi-kosher, like Kutcher's. I don't think anyone really... But I mean, the Grossinger's was considered reliable, but you needed a mashgiach, a hashgacha, because the owners were not religious. But Gartenberg, you know, and the Lake House, I don't know who owned the Lake House, but these were regarded as firm establishments. Just like in Europe, you would have inns that people would come and eat there. And, but that's part of, the lost world of American Orthodoxy that, you know, I'm writing my book on the history of halacha in America. So I'm going to talk about this lost world of American Orthodoxy.
That's where all the weddings were made. I mean, hashgachas were made. I mean, shidduchim were made in pioneer.
Yeah, yeah. Once we got the pioneer, everyone was the pioneer. Although it closed before my time, but yes. Okay, thank you for that very much. Let me take some more.
You've answered my question. You can skip it.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Now, someone privately says that he has in his library a copy of the 19 letters autographed by Drachman as a gift to Rabbi Breuer. Drachman, by his translation of the 19 letters, had a real impact on American Orthodoxy because you didn't have really much Orthodox literature in the English language. And this is the classic work of Orthodoxy in modern times, the 19 letters. And it remained the standard translation for a long, long time to the 60s, as I recall, when the Hirschians did a new translation. And many people grew up in those years when Orthodoxy was a, for example, Rabbi Rakefet tells how his mother-in-law, you know, that was like her Bible, the Drachman edition of the 19 letters, because you didn't have really much in the English language a sophisticated defense of what it means to be a Torah Jew in modern times. So Drachman gets so much credit for this. And I still, I'm not clear as to why he was, maybe he was so defensive because that's where he's a musmach from. Remember, he never went and then got a new smicha from Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan. So maybe subconsciously he has to defend the orthodoxy of his alma mater because no one questioned Drachman's orthodoxy. Zahav says, Ginsburg regarding no difference in Torah rabbinic law is similar to the Hillel story teaching a non-Jew the Aleph Beis. Okay, I think that story is, the story there is just saying that everything is, he's just saying what the most important things are. Everything else now go learned. But they're not really getting into the difference there between rabbinic and not, I would say. The Ginsburg story really collapses because everything is basically from the people. That's the authority. Thank you, Eric, for pointing out Eitz Chaim. Yes. Ruth says, more than Jews keep the Shabbos keeps the Jews. Yes. That's a chada'am. I've showed you in the past how with the Agudas Rabbanim, in a public declaration encouraging Shabbos, signed by Ramosha Feinstein, quotes as a Maimer Chazal, more than the Jews have kept the Shabbos have kept the Jews. So it's one of these phantom Mamre Chazal, which we have a lot of, but in this case, it's actually from Achada'am, not from Chazal. But it's good Jewish teachings. I also showed you in the past that it's good Jewish teaching, and the concept, if not the phrase, the concept is found in classical Sfarim. But the phrase itself is from Achada'am, who comes from, as Mel points out, Achada'am, he comes from a Hasidic background. Nissen says that Tosfos supports the idea that communal practice is revelatory when dealing with the practice of having multiple layers of meat being kosher. Yeah, we did many examples of this, and there's many sources that speak about communal practice as revelatory. That was my point that I said that Zachariah Frankel's idea has you don't even need to go to Tosfos or Rishonim. The Gemara speaks about him. Enu Nevi'im B'nei Nevi'im Heim. Pukhazi, Maya Madvar, and so many examples. And I gave examples of this. So everything we saw in Frankel, I was showing that people might say is controversial, has sources until we got to Lachem Ushmi Sinai, I said, that's really where the rubber hits the road, because that's where it's an authentic theological dispute of consequence. Everything else, I think, it could be justified. Yes, thank you, Uzias. Rehuda was sitting before, when I was just quoting from memory, I wasn't sure, I forgot that it said he was sitting before him, not the, Rabbi Kellen points out that Hirsch's wife is older than him. Interesting. And we have someone worked at the Pioneer as a busboy, and another spent time in Passover. Nissan says that Einach HaNeman Bisurin will put the modern Vodah Kashrus out of business. Well, the thing is that already the Aruch HaShulchan says that when you sell products, that's different, that we don't apply Einach HaNeman Bisurin. So a store, he says. And then we have the Darkei Tshuva mentions in the 19th century. Apparently there were problems, so they made takanot in various places that you need a mashkiach. So it's not, I mean, it isn't, the idea of an hashkacha for religious people is not something just invented in modern times. We have examples of it. On the other hand, we know that in many places they didn't. And I said to Rabbi Reese, I said, well, you know, if you go to Prague today, you have the Chabad restaurant, which everyone eats there. All the Haredim prefer that because they prefer that over the modern Orthodox rabbinate who gives hashkacha. There's no hashkacha in the restaurant in Prague. The Tuda is signed by the rabbi who he has a few restaurants of the Chabad rabbi, but he owns the restaurant. So Rabbi Reese said, well, we can rely on the Nota B'Yehuda. Who's ever raising your hand, I'll get to you in a second. The Nota B'Yehuda says that when you're a traveler, you can eat at places where of a lower standard than when you're home. And we've spoken about this also many times in the past. But the only problem with this is that if you would ask the Chabad rabbi in Prague, he wouldn't say that you can only eat here if you're a traveler. He would say, of course you can eat here. We're 100% kosher, and we're the Chabad house, so you don't need a mashkiach. We are the mashkiach, and like I said, I violate this takana all the time. I'm going to be doing it in a few weeks. I did it last semester. I have an event. People come to my events. I order kosher food. The Rebbetzin makes it. I pay her. It's a little business for her. And, you know, that's Shalom Al Yisrael. Okay.
Thank you for another question.
I'm going to say one more thing. Danny asked, did the seminary endure to the Nazi era? It, as with the Reform and as with the Orthodox Rabbiner Seminar, they all existed through the Nazi era. They closed at different times, either after Kristallnacht or even a little bit later. And all the seminaries existed, and then they ended never to be reopened or in the same form. So I thank you all for your comments, and Rabbi, you can take it away.
Okay, thank you again for another great series. We pick up, of course, next Monday night, no breaks. I don't know how long the next series will be, but I think a little shorter, right? That's the feeling?
Maybe three classes.
Okay, on the Rav's letters, and then we'll go to Rav Hildesheim.
The Rav's letters I discovered and published, because a lot of people ask me about these. And then we're going to move right into Rav Zeldman Bear Bamberger, the verse from the Rav.
Right. Okay. So you heard that. And of course, tomorrow, Rabbi Shulman and Daniel, we have all our regular classes during the week. Actually, we've got two new classes starting this week. Wednesday, Rabbi Yossi Levine will be giving from the Rabbi of the Jewish Center. We'll be beginning a four-part series of the Making of the Shulchan Aruch. And on Thursday, Daniel Lasker gave a fascinating series on Karaism. We'll be giving a three-part series on what it means to be a Jewish philosopher. So those are two new series starting this week, Wednesday and Thursday. Thursday night Parsha Shir this week is Rabbi Mordechai Turchiner, the head of the Kolo Zichron Dov here, the Beit Medrash Zichron Dov here in Toronto. And okay, we look forward to learning through all our regular classes. And yes, Mark mentioned our trip to Tunisia, and Rabbeinu Hananel. I got a few hours left. Today is the sort of the last day of the early bird special for our trips to Greece, Tunisia, and Portugal, which, please God, will are three trips during the summer. So anybody have the buck to travel? These are really wonderful trips. And you get to, you think 1 hour on Monday night, just come on the bus for a 4-hour bus ride when we can, all the places we go. And really, it's a wonderful opportunity, and really wonderful people come on the trips, or those who've been on them. But you want to say something, right, Mark?
No, I just, I don't know if Herbert looked at his text. I texted him something there, but, okay, That's it then. Thank you all.
Okay. Yes, thank you.
Lila
to everybody. We look forward to seeing you soon, and please invite a friend to join. Hope to see you soon. Thanks a lot, everybody. Lila Tov.